Let's cultivate our motivation. And while we have this precious human life, let's use it wisely and not spend it sleeping during meditation, and not spend it on frivolous talk, and not even spend it ruminating in our mind again and again about something. But let's recognize the defilement as defilement, apply the antidote, and then move on so that we can really cultivate our good qualities and purify our mind and make our life meaningful for all sentient beings. And so generate that bodhicitta aspiration for full enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, and make a strong determination to use your life to go in that direction. Some of you were so soundly asleep that you didn't even hear the remark I made in the motivation. Okay. We began a few days ago talking about how the self-grasping ignorance and the self-centered thought were the two major culprits. Yeah. And how from them we developed attachment and anger. And how attachment usually develops first, because, well, if there's a solidly existing me and a solidly existing something else, then the first thing we do, since we want happiness, is we want to attach to the external thing that looks like it's going to give us pleasure. And so that's what attachment is, you know. We're exaggerating the positive qualities of something, holding on to it because we're sure it's going to bring us pleasure and happiness. And then, of course, when that is frustrated, when we can't get what we want, when we lose what we like, when we get what we want, but it isn't as good as it was supposed to be. And when we get problems that we don't want, in all of those conditions, then we, again, exaggerate the negative qualities of them, and animosity, hostility arises. So it's interesting to think about those different situations, to really think about in our life, you know, like how many times each day we don't get what we want, and to check the mind, and how do I respond when I don't get what I want? Yeah. Do I let it go? Do I harbor some kind of for at least for a little while, little irritation, a little annoyance, something like that. What happens when I get what I want, but it's not as good as I thought it was supposed to be? Yeah, and I'm left disillusioned and disappointed and feeling let down. And how do I react like that? How, you know, check the mind again. How do I react when I'm trying so hard to get something and my desires are being frustrated? You know, I want this or I want that, and you know, nobody's realizing, you know, that my idea is the best one, or nobody's giving me the responsibility, or nobody's listening to me, or, you know, when we have a goal and then it's being frustrated, how do we react? You know, do we get angry and blame somebody? Do we give up? I was once talking with somebody, and he was telling me a story about a university professor, and he'd asked the professor, how do you evaluate which students to let into your PhD program. And he says, I watch how they deal with failure. You know? Because when you're doing research and then it falls apart, you know? So he said, I watch how the people deal with failure, with, you know, it not working out. I thought that was quite something, you know? And so, you know, frustration, failure, you know, when our aspirations and dreams don't happen, what happens in our mind? How do we react when we're expecting the day to go one way and then it goes another way? Or when problems come our way that we aren't anticipating? So it's very interesting to kind of check the mind, because, you know, usually we have some negative feeling and, you know, we have some story behind it, like, wait a minute, this isn't how things are supposed to be. Yeah, my rule of the universe said they're supposed to be like this. How come they're like that? Yeah. And this happens every day, doesn't it? Every day. And then we think, oh, if only I had more power, then I could get my way. Well, the powerful people have the same thing, you know, because the people they have power over don't listen to them. So what they want is always getting frustrated too. So, you know, wherever we look, it's like whatever position, whatever status, whatever job we have, you know, there's no way we can control everything around us to make it go the way we want. So often in situations like this, then what we do is we exaggerate, you know, the negative qualities of something and then respond with some degree of hostility or animosity. And so sometimes, you know, it's very subtle. We get a little irritated at somebody for this or that. And sometimes, you know, we're downright outraged or enraged or belligerent or spiteful or rebellious or aggressive or wrathful or, you know, something like that. So it's good to look at the whole spectrum of these kinds of emotions that are based on exaggerating the negative side. But as with attachment, it's especially important to look for the big ones. Okay. Yeah, so like I was saying yesterday, look for the big attachments that really mess up your life. And similarly here, look for the big kind of animosity and anger that you have. And observe, you know, sometimes it's in regard to a specific person. That we were talking the other day, we'll just brand a person, put them in a category, and then everything they say we get mad at. Yeah. So to look, if there's one person that we're continually getting mad at, and if we somehow put them in a category or imputed a certain quality on them or exaggerated something so that we hardly even listen to what they say, but as soon as they open their mouth, we're all set to feel disgruntled. Yeah, or we're all set to feel that they're bossing us around, or we're all set to feel that they're picking on us and putting us down. And we're all set for that, and they're just opening their mouth to say something. Okay? So it's very good to do some reflection on this and see if there's particular people, individuals, or if there's particular kinds of people, like maybe people who have certain habitual personality characteristics that we react against. Okay, so it may not be the same individual, but people have similar characteristics. Or it may be people who have similar positions or roles. Okay, so it may be that we get angry at everybody who we consider in a position of authority. Or maybe we get angry at everybody who, you know, we put in the category of being stupid, or we get angry at everybody who we put in some other category. And so there it's much more a thing of a role, you know. Yeah, anybody who's in a certain position in relationship to us. Okay, so it might be that you get mad at the people you consider under you, or you get mad at the people who you consider over you, or whatever. You know, and these are just societal roles. That's sometimes the role alone, you know, we react a lot to the role. It's good to check that out as well. And then it's interesting to see, too, if there's specific kinds of issues that are objects that we get angry in relation to, you know. So, for example, I was somebody, you know, whenever people borrow money and then they don't return it in a certain amount of time, is that the thing we get angry about? You know, or not necessarily even borrow money, borrow books or borrow whatever, you know, and they don't return it to, you know, is that the thing that sets us off? Or is the thing that sets us off when we think somebody's telling us what to do? Or is the thing that sets us off when we think somebody isn't listening to our instructions? Or is the thing that sets us off when we think somebody is commenting on our appearance? Are we very sensitive about our appearance? Or, you know, are we sensitive about, you know, some other quality that we have, physical quality or emotional quality? And whenever a certain topic of conversation about that quality emerges, we're like all ready, you know, to feel hurt and angry. Okay? So it's quite interesting to spend some time and really think about these different areas, because it gives us a lot of insight, because it shows us our patterns. And when we're aware of our patterns, then it becomes much easier to catch the anger and catch the exaggeration when it's happening. Okay? So let's say we're somebody who's very sensitive about how we look. Yeah? You know? And so, you know, and we can be sensitive about how we look in so many ways. You know, we're too tall, we're too short, we're too fat, we're too thin. We have brown hair and we want blonde hair, and we have blonde hair and we want brown hair, and we have curly hair and we want straight hair, and we have straight hair and we want curly hair. You know, or maybe we have big feet, yeah. Or maybe we walk stooped over, or maybe we, you know, have a high waistline and no waist. Or maybe we have pimples, or maybe, you know, yeah. I mean, we can be, you know, maybe we have a scar, maybe we have, you know, we can be sensitive about so many things, okay? And so it's interesting to notice, you know, when people are talking about appearance, or they're talking about cosmetic things, or, you know, whatever it is, are we kind of sitting there just already feeling a little bit ill at ease, and, you know, kind of want, you know, yeah, kind of, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, I mean, one of the good stories I tell a lot in this regard is a friend of mine was having a baby, and when you have babies, you're supposed to put on weight. You know, I mean, if you don't put on weight, something's wrong. So, of course she put on weight. And so she had the baby, and she was nursing the baby, and you're supposed to have extra weight when you're nursing. And so she was going to take the baby back to see her family for the holidays. And she was telling me, she said, I know when I get off that plane, my sister's going to look at me and say, oh, you've put on weight. And, you know, as she was telling me this, she was like, you could see her getting really angry, yeah, and really kind of, yeah, angry, irritated, you know, like, what's my sister going to make this negative remark about my weight, you know, to me? And, like, her sister wasn't in the room. The situation hasn't even happened, but she was getting mad about it. Yeah? Why? Because there was a lot of attachment to, you know, regarding her weight and her appearance. And it was completely coming from her own mind. It had nothing to do with her sister. Yeah? So we might see that there's certain things like that in our life. You know? Or we might be sensitive about our level of education, or our class, or our who knows what. You know, about our glass frames. We can, you know, our mind can make up anything that it can feel picked on about, okay? And we're very creative at times. Yeah. So just to be aware of that, what kind of stories is my mind making up, and what am I holding on to here? Yeah, I'm holding on to something, I'm clinging on to something, and it's being jeopardized. So it might be that we want somebody's approval and we feel like they aren't approving of us. Yeah, it might be that they notice a fault and, you know, we want to have a good reputation and pretend we don't have any faults. And, you know, like she was saying last night, you know, what that person said about her room is true. You know, it's a mess. But I don't like somebody telling me my room is a mess, even though it's true. Yeah. So, kind of, why? What's going on with us? And then you might wonder, well, what's the exaggeration here that we're getting angry? Well, that kind of thing, you know, somebody's saying your room's a mess. Yeah. And then we're exaggerating the negative impact of that statement, you know? And I mean, really, what's the negative impact of the statement somebody's saying your room's a mess? Yeah? I mean, if it's true, your room's a mess. It's just a factual statement. But what does our mind do? They're saying, my room's a mess, so they're saying I'm a bad person. Yeah? And I'm attached to my reputation, and I don't want to be considered a bad person. And I want people to praise me, and they're blaming me. Maybe the person has no idea to blame at all. Maybe the person is not giving us a bad reputation. But we interpret it that way, and then we think, oh, this is terrible. A bad reputation is horrible. It's going to destroy me. You know, somebody not approving of what I'm doing, something's wrong. Something's wrong with me. I don't fit in this world. This is a disaster. Okay? So do you see how our mind is exaggerating? Yeah? Do you see how we're exaggerating? But we don't see, you know, we usually don't see we're exaggerating. We think that what we're telling ourselves is completely true. Somebody doesn't approve of me? Oh, something must be wrong with me. You know, we believe that. We believe that. We're totally hooked into that. Yeah? Because somebody disapproves of us, does that mean something's wrong with us? No. No. We have to look inside of ourselves and look what our action is and look what our motivation is. And then we have to decide if something needs altering or not. But just because somebody says something, it doesn't mean something's wrong with us. And we take everything so personally. Yeah, your room's a mess. Oh, they're criticizing me. They don't like me. You know, or you talk too loud. Oh, something's wrong. They don't approve of me. They say I talk too loud, or I talk too much, or I don't talk enough, or, you know, and we take everything so personally. Yeah? So you can see how it's really a function of the self-centered thought, isn't it? You know, somebody else does that says, oh, you talk too loud. You know, well, it's true, yeah, that guy does talk too loud, you know. So we don't get bummed out when somebody says, you know, Joe over here talks too loud. But when they say that we talk too loud, oh, yeah. So you see just the exaggeration in it, and taking everything so personally that isn't meant personally at all. Yeah. So we can see so clearly how the self-centered thought, and that, you know, makes us very oversensitive, and how the attachment to very petty things sets the stage for being oversensitive. And then, you know, we just spin off on something. Yeah? And then we're just upset the whole day and depressed the whole day. And then we develop a whole self-image. Everybody's always picking on me. Nobody understands me. The whole world is against me. Do you see how exaggeration comes in here? Yeah? I mean, we just take a small thing and then we just exaggerate and write this huge, enormous story. You know? And it's all so totally unnecessary. Totally unnecessary. Mm-hmm. Okay? So it's good to notice these things in ourselves. And then not to, again, do the same thing and exaggerate the importance of that and say, oh, I'm so terrible because I'm so super sensitive, you know. And then I'm terrible because I get mad at myself because I'm super sensitive. You know? It's like, I call it cyclic existence. You know, it's like we're on this merry-go-round and we just change horses. But we keep getting stuck on the same merry-go-round. You know? So it's really important. And I think this is why it's really important to have a sense of humor about ourselves. And when we see ourselves doing this, just to be able to laugh, you know, instead of taking ourselves so seriously all the time. I mean, I remember once in retreat, sitting there, and, you know, of course, you know, you're doing retreat, and you like to think that you're this kind of really fantastic meditator, and, you know, you're almost close to getting somewhere. And so, you know, here I'm meditating, and I'm doing my sessions very regularly, and okay, there's some distraction, but I catch it, you know. And I'm sure, you know, my teacher has clairvoyant powers, so he knows that I'm in retreat doing this wonderful meditation, keeping very strict discipline. I must be a really good disciple. I'm sure he knows that. You know? And this kind of thought goes through your mind. Yeah? And then, you know, I remember that happening in one retreat, and I realized that was going on. I just cracked up in the middle of the meditation. I just started laughing. It was like, my goodness, this is hilarious. Look at what my mind is doing. You know, it's just making up this thing that really is pretty funny. You know? Isn't it funny? I thought it was hilarious. You know? And so we just have to learn to laugh at ourselves when we see our mind spinning out like this. And, you know, and we have to laugh at ourselves and how silly we are and how stupid we are. And, you know, it's just we're sentient beings, and it's funny. Don't you think? Yeah? I mean, we have to laugh at ourselves. Okay, so, you know, especially what we're laughing at is all this kind of exaggeration going on, you know, in our mind. Just super exaggeration. How we get ourselves so tied up, you know? And so hostility and confusion really come in all of this. I remember another situation, just probably about 20 years ago, I was at Tushita in India, and I was, Lama Zopa had asked me to co-teach a course, you know, so the course went on, I don't know, three weeks or something. And so I was teaching every morning, and Lama Zopa was there at the retreat center at the time. And every morning, like at 4:30 or something, you know, he would call some of us into the room and we would do the Lama Chöpa Puja together. And then after that, I would kind of go and teach the course. And so already I was kind of short on sleep, you know, kind of going into the Rinpoche's room at 4:30 in the morning and then teaching. And then one night, there's this one practice, it's called a self-initiation practice. And when Rinpoche was going to start doing it at 8 o'clock, and he invited some of us to come. So Rinpoche's 8 o'clock means like 10 o'clock, means you finish at 6 o'clock. If it's on time. You know? And I was thinking, oh, I really want to go to this, but if I stay up all night, I'm not going to be able to teach the next day. So I'm already short of sleep, and, you know, I have to teach this course. But, you know, he invited me, and, you know, I'm just wanting to sleep. I'm really bad because I want to sleep. If I had more compassion, for sentient beings, then I would just readily go through the difficulties of staying up all night, and I wouldn't get tired the next day, and I would go into the meditation hall the next day completely beaming, even though I hadn't slept, and it's all because I'm so selfish and I have no compassion for sentient beings, and I want to sleep instead of go to this puja. And, you know, I hear of my opportunities to renew my tantric vows, and all I want to do is go to bed. And, you know, what a horrible person I am, and a horrible disciple. You know, so selfish and no wisdom. I have this great opportunity, and I'm blowing it because I want to go to sleep. But if I stay up all night, then the teaching I give these people won't be very clear, and then I'll be really an awful person, and I'll be letting these people down because I'll be so exhausted, and I'll give an unclear teaching. So then it was like, you know, if I go to the puja, I'm doing it wrong, and if I don't go to the puja, I'm also doing it wrong. Yeah? Okay? Because if I go, then I'm going to be tired, then I'm going to let the students down, get an awful teaching, and then my reputation will be trash, and I'll let Rinpoche down. But if I go to the puja, you know, if I don't go to the puja and I sleep, then I'm an awful student, I'm letting him down, I'm so selfish. So I got myself really good and tangled up. You know, this is, if I do this, I'm bad, and if I do that, I'm bad, and, you know, whatever I do, I'm bad. Yeah? It's incredible. And so I spun around this, you know. I just was, like, worried about this. I don't know how many hours I just spent worrying about it and beating myself up because, you know, I'm too selfish and I'm too this and I'm too that. Beating myself up. And so finally, you know, everybody's going in there to do the puja, and I just said, I have to go to bed because otherwise I'm not going to function tomorrow morning, you know. I'm just going to be wiped out. So I went to bed, and I felt guilty the whole night sleeping, and I woke up feeling guilty. I was such a bad person. So I went in later that day to see Rinpoche. And, you know, and here I'm talking about self-anger, you know, not just hostility towards others, but anger towards myself. So I'm so upset at myself, and I'm feeling so bad. And I go into Rinpoche, I'm so sorry I didn't come to the puja last night. And he says, Ben? And I say, oh, I was so selfish and uncompassionate, and I just had to go to sleep. Ben? And meanwhile, while he's doing this, while I'm saying all this, he's busy doing something. It's like he's writing something, and, you know, I'll kind of pour stuff out, and he'll look up occasionally and go, Ben? And then go back, and he's, you know, whatever he was doing, rearranging or writing something or whatever. And I'm just going, you know, I'm so bad, and, no, you know, but, you know, if I stayed up all night, I wouldn't be able to teach the next day. Ben? And, you know, but if I didn't go to the puja, I didn't renew my tantric vows, and I missed, you know, I'm creating so much negative karma, then. And, you know, everything I said, all I would do is just occasionally look up and go, then. And it took a while until I realized that Rinpoche was completely bored. You know? He was completely bored. You know, and so he's just looking up and then back to what he's doing. You know? Because my drama, oh, my aching heart and my self-hatred, and, you know, it was like totally irrelevant. You know? He was bored. And it was like, oh, children, maybe you better be quiet and stop wasting this time. You know, because what I was doing, why was I going on and on with him about it? I wanted absolution. Yeah, I wanted him to take it and say, oh, little girl, you made the right decision. And it was a good decision after all. And even if it wasn't, I forgive you. And he was not buying into my little trip. He was not buying into my trip for absolution and approval. And he was just, you know, I'm just saying, figure it out yourself and look at your own mind and, you know. And it's like, I don't know what I did. You know, that's like completely, I don't, it's so interesting because this thing that I thought was so important that I had to confess to him immediately, it was like, he didn't care. And what he wanted me to do was look at my own self and, you know, figure it out myself. And eventually I figured out, well, yeah, I needed to go to sleep. I'm not a Buddha yet. It had nothing to do with me being too selfish. Yeah, I'm not a Buddha. I have a human body. My human body needs to rest. And my first responsibility is to the people in this course. And so I have to take care of what my first responsibility is, and if that meant giving up something else, then that's okay. And I don't need to beat myself up about it because, you know, my body needs to rest. Yeah. But it was a really good experience. It was really good that he turned it right back on me. Yeah. And he didn't give me absolution. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay, so here we're talking about a situation where we get mad at ourselves, and we have a lot of self-hatred and self-blame, and we spin around that one. Okay, yeah. And so it's very interesting to spend some time to really look at, you know, how is it that we make up all these stories and then spin around them and get stuck in them and hate ourselves about them and, you know... I mean, because if my friend had had that same situation and that same quandary, I would have said, go to sleep. Yeah? I would have said, you know, your responsibility is these people, you have a human body, it's go to sleep. You know, but for myself, I couldn't do that. Because I had to be, you know, perfect, something, something, something. You know, it's totally unrealistic. Right? So really, you know, looking at sometimes how we beat ourselves up. And I think what Jim said last night about controlling the world, and you know, that it's really, really exhausting managing the world. And when we're trying to manage others, we're also doing the same thing. You know, we're being very hard on others, and we're also being very hard on ourselves at the same time. But very often, we are so used to this negative self-talk and this self-hatred that we don't even realize it as a defilement. Yeah? We just think it's normal. And we just think it's the way we're supposed to feel. Because we are really so bad. Yeah? And so we completely space out and don't realize all this self-hatred and guilt is a defilement. Now, isn't that amazing? Yeah? I mean, sometimes when we're angry at other people, you know, we can kind of realize that's a defilement because we're unhappy when we're angry at them. Yeah? And so when we're unhappy, you know, we can say, oh, maybe, you know, I need to change my mind. But then, if we've been beating up on ourselves for so long, well, that's just normal. That's just, of course, how I relate to myself. Is there any other way to relate to myself besides hating myself? You know? It's like we're at a total loss. Yeah? Completely without any skills, like... If I don't hate myself, well, what am I going to do? Yeah? What am I going to think about myself? Who am I going to be? You know, how dare I be so arrogant and think something kind about myself? How dare I think that I have any good qualities and something to offer? That's really selfish and bad. And you know what? It's also attachment to reputation. So I'm fully immersed in the eight worldly dharmas. So we completely take the Dharma and then we use the Dharma to beat up on ourselves. Oh, how dare I think I have any good quality. How selfish, how arrogant. I'm going to the hell realms for that. How awful I am. You know? We just take the Dharma and then hate ourselves because we falsely impose some aspect of the Dharma on our mind. Okay? So all of this is just, this is all just exaggeration, isn't it? It's just all complete, the mind making stories and exaggerating, and that's why I think sometimes to be able to catch this in ourselves and see how we're melodramatic. Many of you have heard that my parents, when I was a kid, used to call me Sarah Bernhardt. Yeah, Sarah Bernhardt was some, you know, in the silent movies, I guess, was, you know, just melodramatic, everything, you know. And I thought, you know, why are they calling me Sarah Bernhardt, you know? They don't understand my emotions. And meanwhile, it's like everything that happened, and I had journals, and, you know, since I don't know what grade, and, you know, my sixth grade friends are picking at me, and they kick me out of the group, and they don't love me, and my parents did this, and my brother did that, and it's just so melodramatic. And not just when I was a kid, you know, my whole teenage years I was melodramatic, into my 20s I was melodramatic, maybe a little bit now, but you know, I'm hoping I've improved a little bit. But boy, especially my late teens, early 20s, I was just like, whoa, you know? And I couldn't see it at all. You know, I couldn't see it at all that I was being melodramatic. And meanwhile, my parents were saying, you're like Sarah Bernhardt. Oh, Sarah Bernhardt. Huh? These are my feelings. And nobody wants to hear my feelings. And they changed from 1 minute ago. And just, and you know, finally I got to a point where I could laugh at myself, you know, and look back at myself and just laugh and, you know, not take myself so seriously for having so much, creating so much melodrama in my life, you know, because that's where I was at that time. But boy, you know, I was really into it. And then especially I was into this thought, how come nobody loves me? All I want is for somebody to love me, and nobody loves me. You know, all these guys I date, they like me, but, you know, they don't love me unconditionally. Want them to love me unconditionally and accept me for everything I am. I thought I could just open myself up and share everything with them. And no wonder the guys ran away. No wonder, you know, I was what you would call high maintenance. Yeah, and I couldn't see it at all. Yeah, boy. Anyway, but you see, you know, now, I mean, at least now I can look back at it. I have some compassion for that person I was. She was like really stuck in a lot of suffering. But I can also laugh at what was going on in my mind. You know, it was pretty funny what was going on in my mind.
So we talk about karma propensity?
Was all that a karma propensity? Probably had something to do with karma, but it probably had something to do with the way I was thinking in this life, too. And it probably had to do because I was more selfish than everybody else. Nobody else was as self-centered as I was. That's definitely it.
I'm trying to untangle where the ignorance sits in this. So you started with Rinpoche.
Mm-hmm.
Was there also...
not just the quality of story, but was
this poison of ignorance also at work in trying to make a decision, getting all tangled up and not knowing how to do it? Would you say that?
Well, in one way.
The importance of I.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, it was definitely I'm so important. But she was talking more, because I was talking about wrong views and not understanding the cause and effect. So I think that's more what you're referring to. Yeah.
I'm trying to, since you've taught on it, I'm really trying to see how does that work in life?
Yeah.
So I was wondering if that
would reflect story. Okay. Well, where the ignorance came in there is thinking that it was good to beat myself up so much. Yeah. That's what the ignorance was. I thought it was good to beat myself up. Yeah. Like if I wasn't hard on myself, then somehow I wasn't sincerely trying to practice the Dharma. I was just brushing it off. Yeah. Yeah.
And attached to the idea of suffering through Dharma.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, all of them. Well, I was very attached to my reputation. I was attached to approval.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the ignorance and thinking, oh, it's good to be so hard on myself. That means I'm really practicing. Yeah. And then the hostility, because I was just sitting there blaming myself for so much. So you say that when that you kind of have your own rendition of my Theravada, and that it, how much it clouds the mind and keeps you from making a decision, and that's really true, isn't it? The mind becomes so clouded because if I do this, I'm bad, and if I do that, I'm bad. Yeah, and the mind is actually so narrow. Because it's only seeing doing this and blaming myself and doing that and blaming myself. And those are the only two alternatives it's seeing. And in fact, there's like a bunch of other alternatives, like accepting myself who I am and giving myself some space and being kind to myself. I don't see that alternative. Yeah? I'm totally immune to that one. Or I don't see the alternative of, you know, yeah, just accepting, and, you know, I'm sure my teacher understands, I'm sure the other people understand, you know, anyway, all my Dharma friends, are, you know, they're not going to spend the whole day thinking about me and how bad I was because I didn't go, yeah. So, you know, it's like the mind can't think of any other alternatives, and that's where we really get stuck. And so I think when we get in that kind of state, at least I know when I get in a confused state about a decision, then I just say, I don't need to make a decision right now. Yeah, I'm not making a decision right now. My mind's too confused. I'm putting this down. Yeah, because my mind is, yeah, it's just too confused right now. And so put it down, go and do something else, air out the mind. Yeah, think about some other things. Yeah, read a Dharma book, you know, because you know, at least at that point when we're spinning so much, you know, at least if we can recognize, hey, my mind's so confused, I can't make a decision. So the wise thing to do now is just put it aside and not decide now, and I don't have to decide now. Mm-hmm.
So I'll just start with one. Okay, got it. So someone came up to me recently and said that they don't understand why therapists or, you know, sort of counseling groups say you're not the only one. You know, with the problem. She says so many people want to be the only one. So she doesn't really know how that's supposed to be comforting for people when so many people want to be the only one. And that's an ego-sensitive issue that they're like, I'm the only one with this, and I'm blah, blah, blah. And then most of the time, it's not that, like, oh, I'm the only one, I'm all alone. It's like, I'm the only one with my problem. No one understands where I'm coming from. No one understands what, like, no one suffers with me. And so she doesn't know why people take that approach. So I just thought it was sort of interesting when she told me that. But I also had a question about, so there are a lot of people who have a lot of melodrama, just like you're explaining, but totally within themselves. There's no, they spend all their time not showing it. So, okay, they can take failure. They can not have approval. But that doesn't mean that they're beating themselves up inside and they're having trouble with decision and whatever I do aren't bad. So what do you do if you're struggling with the fact that you don't show your melodrama? You have it, but you just don't show it. And sometimes I find that can cause quite a bit of, also quite a bit of suffering. Because you spend so much time on both those, on not showing it and having it. That can be quite overwhelming for one.
So you're saying somebody might have a lot of melodrama, but they're keeping it inside and presenting a good face to the world.
Yeah.
Okay. But then you were saying something like they're not attached to approval?
Well, for example, I'm sure they are attached to approval, of course, but they don't want to show
it. Oh, they don't want to show it. Okay. But they are. Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, that somebody can be, totally cool with this. But, you know, you can usually see some cracks through the veneer. Yeah, because it comes out in some other way. And, you know, there's still the attachment to approval and beating themselves up and everything else. And maybe even more attachment to approval because they don't want anybody to disapprove of them for being so melodramatic. Yeah. And so what's your question about that?
I'm just wondering, in general, It seems rather, you know, you're giving us tools, but it's easier said than done. I'm just wondering, if this is a very normal behavior for one person. That, I mean, sure, you can try to be aware of it, but I'm not able to grasp my mind around how you change it. I have no idea how you can do that.
Yeah. Okay. So I think, yeah, that's maybe more the question of, like, okay, you can see your mind doing this stuff, but, like, how do I change it? And these sound like good tools and they make sense, but what do I do with this berserk mess inside me? Yeah? Everybody feel that way? You're not the only one. Actually, I found that it's usually relieving for people to find out that they're not the only one. Yeah, that usually people feel quite relieved. My experience with this is that I just take some of the teachings and, you know, look at, okay, here I am stuck in thinking in this pattern. Okay, how about if I try to think in this pattern? Okay, and so I consciously try to direct my mind to think in another way to see if that other way makes more sense than the way I'm already thinking. Okay? Or I might look, sometimes before I do that, I'll spend some time just asking myself, is the way I'm thinking reasonable? Okay? Like in this example. Okay, is it reasonable to expect myself to be able to stay up all night doing puja and teach a course the next day? Is that a reasonable thing to expect of a regular person? You know, would I expect that of somebody else? No. You know, I wouldn't expect that of somebody else. That's not a reasonable thing to expect of another person. Okay. And then I would ask myself, is it true that if you don't go to the puja, that the reason is that you lack compassion for sentient beings? Yeah? Is that the reason? And what's difficult in this one is my teacher hardly sleeps. You know, and I think it's because he has such great compassion that he doesn't sleep and he's always practicing. Okay, so I might say, well, it's true that if somebody's a bodhisattva and has great compassion, they may not sleep because of the power of their compassion. Okay, but I am not a bodhisattva. Yeah, and nobody's expecting me to be one today. Yeah. I mean, my teacher, everybody else knows I'm not a bodhisattva. When you get to that point on the path where you are a bodhisattva, then staying up all night by the power of your compassion is easy. It's not difficult. Yeah, it's easy. So I'm not there yet. So does that mean I lack compassion? Well, you could say I don't have the compassion of a bodhisattva, but does that mean I'm a bad person because I don't have a bodhisattva's compassion? Does that mean I'm a bad person? No, it doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It means I am what I am. You know, I'm not a bodhisattva. I don't have that level of compassion. Yeah. But how fortunate I am that I've met the teachings. Someday I'm going to be like my teacher. Some lifetime I'm going to be like that. So I can go in that direction. But, you know, he's not expecting me to be like that right now. Why do I expect myself to be like that? That's not reasonable at all. Okay? So you see, kind of questioning my thought processes and seeing if the way I'm thinking is reasonable. You know? Is it reasonable to think that I should be a bodhisattva? No, that's not reasonable. Is it reasonable to blame an ordinary sentient being for not being compassionate? No. It's like blaming a pig for not being able to talk. You know? Or forget, you know, when he's a pig, blaming one of the kitties. You know, it's like blaming one of the kitties for not being able to talk. How can you blame a kitty for not being able to talk? They don't have that ability. Okay? So I don't have that ability to be a bodhisattva, you know, by tonight and stay up all night. You know, so let's stop blaming myself. Because that's not reasonable to think in that way. Okay? So I'll question, I'll kind of pull out the quote-unquote logical arguments that I'm giving my mind. You know, I'll track the reasoning in it. And then I'll start questioning that reasoning. And is that valid? Well, no, it's not. It's, you know, it's not a logical, reasonable way to see the situation. Okay. So what is more logical and reasonable? Yeah. Well, how would Chenrezig see me at this point? Yeah. Chenrezig would say, oh, you have a precious human life. You've met the Dharma. You have the opportunity to practice. You're so fortunate you get to teach this course because teaching really helps you learn better. You know? And you have the ability to help these other people, and that's your responsibility, to do your best helping them right now. Yeah? That's what Chenrezig would say to me. And that certainly makes a lot of sense. Okay? So is that helping?
Yeah.
What is it?
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
I kind of have a question, but I think I might be able to apply that to what I was thinking, which is, how do you know when you're pushing yourself to a good degree and not going too far?
Okay. So how do you know when you're giving yourself an appropriate nudge versus when you're pushing yourself too much? Okay. If your mind is tight, you're pushing yourself too much. Okay, if your mind is confused, you're pushing yourself too much. Yeah. If your mind is sitting there spinning around, you know, telling yourself how awful you are, you're pushing yourself too much. Okay? What if then you're always pushing yourself too much? You know? And what you need to do is look, and like, it's kind of like looking at your mind as you would look at a child. You know? And you talk to your mind as you would talk to a little child. Yeah? It's like, okay, here, we're going to sit, we're going to do this right now. So you look at your mind, you know, when you look at a child, you don't expect somebody who's 3 to be an Olympic champion. Yeah, they're 3 years old. They aren't even ready for training wheels. They're still on a tricycle. So you say, come, let's sit and ride the tricycle. And I'm going to stand here with you and ride the tricycle. Oh, you fell off your tricycle? That's okay. Get back on. Yeah? You won't always fall off your tricycle. It happened this time, but you're not hurt and mortally wounded, so just get back on your tricycle and let's keep on trying to learn to master the tricycle. And then after you master the tricycle, then you can try training wheels, and then you can ride a bike, and then you can do these other things. But, you know, you fell off the tricycle, that's okay. You know, get back on. That's the important thing. Okay? Yeah? So kind of, you know, being gentle with ourselves, like you're gentle with a child. We've got to stop being army drill sergeants.
And it's also a ridiculous issue, but something that's really heavy in my mind, where on the one hand, I feel like I'm almost sometimes too lazy and I need to push myself to the point, but then I have really high expectations that I need to push myself equal to everyone else who are, you know, on the path or whatnot, and so I push myself too hard while being too lazy, and I don't know how to get out of this cycle, you know.
Okay. Anybody else have that problem? Yeah? Yeah. And this is very much our problem, that on one hand, we can get very lazy and not give ourselves that nudge. And then when we try and give ourselves a nudge, we go to the other extreme and we're pushing ourselves. So we're a drill sergeant. But then if we let up being a drill sergeant, then we go back to just lying in bed all day.
Yeah. And then we use your teachings to make to make an excuse for why I can push myself hard enough to get out of bed.
Yeah, okay. Right. Oh, she said don't push myself, so 11 o'clock I'll get up. Yeah.
I don't know how you get start getting out of that mess.
I think what can be very helpful is I think we need to figure out a structure that works for us. And of course that's going to differ because we aren't the same person all the time. So we have to adjust our structure from time to time. But we can get some kind of approximate structure on what we need to do. And just to know, you know, okay, how much sleep do I need? Yeah? And do I really need that much sleep, or can I, if I cut it down by a little bit, can I function just as well? Yeah, because sometimes we think, well, I need to just sleep until I wake up naturally. I don't think so. I'm not an advocate of that, you know? Okay, because I don't know about you. If I did that, boy. Yeah? So, okay, I need to use an alarm clock. So approximately how much sleep do I need each night to be able to function the next day? Well, you know, I try it this way and that way, and kind of this much does it. Now I can go for a few days with getting less sleep, and I'm okay. Yeah? But if I go for too many days getting less sleep, then it doesn't work. Okay, so I got to watch, and, you know, if I do 2-3 days with less sleep, that's fine, but I got to make sure that, you know, I kind of get myself to bed in a certain time so I can sleep that amount. Okay? And so then sometimes you have to adjust it. I find in the summer I don't need as much sleep. Yeah? Kind of, I like the I keep my blinds open in the summer, you know, on the east side, so the sun shines in, because I love waking up to the sun like that. So I don't need as much sleep. I'm wide awake. That's great. Okay? So you kind of figure out what you need to work. Yeah? So it's like that with all these different kinds of things. You know, how much time do I need just to sit and, you know, get in touch with what's going on in my mind? Well, I better take that time to do that. Yeah? And not push myself working so hard that I don't have enough time to just sit and kind of process things that are going on in my mind. And so just to kind of know what we require at any particular time. Yeah. And then, like I said, sometimes it changes. Yeah, sometimes we can do more, sometimes we can do less. And then I've also learned that when I can't, you know, it's very good. I function very well when I keep my body on a particular structure. Yeah, and kind of go to bed the same time, wake up at the same time, and eat at the same time. My body functions much better if I do that. But then I travel. Okay? And I travel a lot, and my body can't always do that. So, you know, then I just have to get used to doing that. And okay, for a few days when I travel, I don't feel well, and that's okay. And I don't blow it up into my mind of, oh, I didn't get any sleep, this is terrible, and my digestive system is off, and this is terrible. You know, it's like, okay, I don't need to blow this up into some stupendous thing. My body just gets out of sync, and I don't feel well, and that's okay, and I keep on working, and I don't need to tell everybody about it and make a big deal, because it'll go away. Yeah? So it's so something like that. Okay, let's take quiet.